The motorcycles come first. Always the motorcycles. 30 men on Honda bikes moving in formation through a Kingston neighborhood that has not yet decided which party it belongs to. They don't announce themselves. They don't need to. The sound is enough. Engines rising and then dropping to idle. Boots on pavement. The particular silence that falls when 30 armed men stop moving and start watching. A woman in a doorway pulls her child behind her without looking down. A man on a corner becomes suddenly interested in something across the street. The motorcycles are not transport. In Kingston in the early 1970s, they are a sentence, and everyone on that block understands exactly what it says. Winston Blake, known everywhere as Bury Boy, is at the front. He is not hiding. That is the point. He has never hidden. There is one detail that would circulate through these same streets for years after his death, never confirmed, never officially investigated, never resolved. A civil servant at the Ministry of Housing. Questions he started asking about payments. The way those questions stopped. Nobody spoke about it openly. Nobody brought it to the police. In Arnett Gardens, silence was its own kind of testimony. But that story belongs to the end. First, you need to understand how a man becomes powerful enough that his silence is worth buying, and how Jamaica built the architecture that made men like him not just possible, but necessary. The first garrison was not built by criminals. It was built by a politician. In the mid-1960s, D.C. Tavares, Jamaica Labour Party Minister of Housing, developed a housing community in West Kingston and filled it with JLP supporters. The development would eventually be known as Tavares Gardens, or in the language of the streets, Payne Land. It was not charity. It was infrastructure, a self-contained loyalist block, planted in the heart of Kingston, where residency came with an obligation. The party gave you the roof, and when the time came, you gave the party your vote, and if it was asked of you, your body. Edward Sega expanded the model. Between 1963 and 1966, thousands of residents in the Backawall area, Rastafarians, squatters, PNP sympathizers, were cleared from their land to make way for what became Tivoli Gardens, a self-contained JLP fortress in the heart of West Kingston, its loyalty to Sega engineered into the architecture itself. The message was clear to anyone who had eyes to read it. Political power in Jamaica would now be measured not just in votes, but in controlled territory. The PNP watched and took notes. When Michael Manley swept to power in 1972 on the electricity of democratic socialism, his Minister of Construction and Housing was Anthony Spaulding, a hard political operator who represented South St. Andrew and who understood garrisons the way most ministers understood legislation. Spaulding moved fast. He developed Arnett Gardens on land adjacent to Trenchtown and Rayma, filling new concrete high-rises and low-cost housing blocks with PNP supporters. The community was named after Vernon Arnett, a PNP stalwart who had represented South St. Andrew Central. JLP sympathetic residents who had occupied the area were displaced. Some of them pushed toward Central Village and the hills of St. Catherine, with a kind of persuasion that left no room for debate. What rose from that displacement was a neighborhood that would be known, for decades, as the Concrete Jungle. The name was not a metaphor. It was a description. Concrete towers rising from land scraped clean of the people who hadn't voted correctly, surrounded by communities where the war between the parties had already turned lethal. And inside that jungle, two men were already building something the PNP would use and eventually be unable to control. Winston Blake had been operating in Kingston's political underground since at least the late 1960s. His partner was George Spence, known as Feathermop for the gray dreadlocked mass of hair that fell from his head like a dismantled mop. Together they led a gang reported to number around 30 men, every one of them mounted on a Honda motorcycle. From 1967 onward, Bury Boy and Feathermop had been instrumental in delivering Manley's wins in the newly formed Central Kingston constituency. The relationship between the gang and the party was never made official. It functioned in the way all these arrangements functioned in 1970s Kingston, understood by everyone, acknowledged by no one in writing, enforced by men whose names appeared in no party manifesto, but whose influence shaped every outcome that mattered. What separated Bury Boy from a standard garrison enforcer was the dimension of his visibility. He was not a shadow operator. He appeared at political rallies. He moved among PNP officials with the ease of a trusted aide. He was present at public events as a deterrent made flesh, close enough to the party's public face that the line between criminal and political operative had effectively ceased to exist. This proximity was known. It was, in its way, the point. The political machinery that Bury Boy served did not want him invisible. They wanted him seen. Seen by rivals. Seen by communities that had not yet committed their loyalty. Seen by ordinary Kingstonians who needed to understand which party had the men willing to enforce its interests at street level. He was the party's deterrent, announced in advance. The community that developed around him in Arnett Gardens absorbed this logic completely, and somewhere in the daily operations of that community, the favors given, the disputes resolved, the rents intervened in, the rivals expelled, a government housing contract changed hands. Payments were made. A Ministry of Housing official noticed the direction those payments had taken. By 1974, the gang's operations had widened from community enforcement to something more directly political and more nakedly violent. Manley had formally committed the PNP to democratic socialism, a declaration that electrified the Jamaican left and alarmed the Jamaican right in equal measure. The ideological temperature of the island was rising fast, and in Kingston's garrisons, ideology was translated immediately into territory and terror. In November 1974, a cluster of incidents made visible exactly how far beyond anyone's control Bury Boy and Feathermop had traveled. A JLP activist is shot. Mourners at the funeral of another JLP loyalist are attacked. Opposition members of parliament, attempting to enter Gordon House, are mobbed and turned back. All within the same month. Rapid, coordinated. The work of men who feel no particular concern about being held accountable. Then the gang invades a JLP meeting at Tavares Gardens and issues a warning. No memorial should be held for D.C. Tavares, who has just died. The message is delivered not as a request. Then comes the labor dispute. Disgruntled port workers represented by the university and allied workers' union have gone on strike. The workers' cause is legitimate. Their representative, Trevor Monroe, is no JLP man. He is a PNP figure, a leftist academic and political ally of the party's own base. It does not matter. Bury Boy and Feathermop's gang descends on the striking workers and their representatives. Monroe receives several chops across his body. He is seriously injured. The workers are assaulted and driven off. The attack on Monroe makes something visible that Manley's government had been carefully looking past. These men do not distinguish between enemies and inconvenient allies. They enforce not a political position, but a raw territorial logic. Anyone who disrupts the order they have been given permission to maintain is a target. Ideology is irrelevant. So is party membership. The gang also storms the JLP headquarters at Retirement Road. A 70-year-old watchman named Vassal Black is stabbed. Research officer Sexton Hope is slashed. These are not battles between armed combatants. They are demonstrations, exercises in the breadth of impunity, available to men the ruling party has decided to protect. Think carefully about what you are being asked to accept here. The dominant narrative of 1970s Jamaica places Michael Manley at the center of a noble democratic socialist project, a leader trying to redistribute wealth and dignity to the Jamaican poor, besieged by CIA interference, capital flight, and JLP opposition. That narrative is not entirely wrong, but it is incomplete in a way that matters enormously. Because the Democratic Socialist Project was built in significant part on the labor of men like Bury Boy, the garrison communities that delivered Manley his electoral victories were not organic expressions of PNP loyalty. They were engineered, built by Spalding's housing ministry populated by the displacement of political opponents and protected by gang violence that the party did not stop because the party needed what the violence produced. Manley publicly condemned the attacks when they could no longer be ignored. He condemned the chopping of Trevor Monroe. The condemnations changed nothing. The gang continued operating. The protection continued. The political calculus that had made Bury Boy useful had not changed, and a public statement of regret was not the same thing as withdrawal of the arrangement. This is the contradiction that the standard historical account of the Manley era cannot comfortably contain. The man who spoke most eloquently about equality and justice in Jamaican public life was also the man whose cabinet formally deliberated and voted on whether to attend the funeral of a gang enforcer. Across the line in Rema and Tivoli, the JLP's own enforcers were watching all of this with the specific attention of men who have been through the same education. Claude Massop, Carl Baya Mitchell, Curly Locks, the JLP's top enforcer in Rema. These men understood exactly what Bury Boy and Feathermop were building, because Sega had already built the same thing. The tribal warfare that erupted between these garrisons throughout the early to mid-1970s was not crime in any conventional sense. It was politics continued by other means, the street-level consequence of a system that had decided to outsource enforcement to armed men, and those men were now running their own war with their sponsors' colors on, but their own logic driving every decision. The residents of Lizard Town on the outskirts of Tivoli Gardens paid the cost of those reprisals. PNP supporters there were attacked in retaliation for what Bury Boy's gang had done across the line. The chain was self-replicating, each attack generating the justification for the next, each death producing a generation of sons who remembered. The thing about power that operates outside the law is that it must constantly perform. It cannot rest. It cannot become ordinary. Every favor must be matched by a fear maintained. Bury Boy understood this. He provided. Residents in Arnett Gardens who needed something, protection from a rival gang, intervention with a landlord, food during hard times, resolution of a community dispute, could bring these matters to him, and he would resolve them, not through any legal mechanism, through the weight of who he was, and what everyone knew he was capable of. This is how dons are made in Jamaica, not through wealth alone, not through brutality alone, but through the particular fusion of the two that makes a man feel, to the people beneath him, like the closest thing to government they have ever actually experienced. The PNP provided the housing blocks. Bury Boy provided the daily governance. The PNP got the votes. Bury Boy got the myth. That myth grew densest around the question that Arnett Gardens would never fully answer. How much of what he did was for the community, and how much was for himself? The people who received his protection had every reason to remember the former. The people he expelled, attacked, or silenced had every reason to remember the latter. Both answers were true, and that irresolution sat at the core of everything he had built. Somewhere in those years of provision and fear, quietly, in the way that rumors travel between people who trust each other just enough. That story about the Ministry of Housing official began circulating again. The payments that had gone in the wrong direction. The official who started asking questions. The way the questions stopped. Nobody took it to a newspaper. Nobody took it to the police. The official's name does not appear in any official record in connection with Bury Boy. What happened to him has never been formally established, and the Jamaica Observer reporting treats it as rumor rather than proven fact. But in the garrison, the silence around the story was its own verdict. It said, "This man stands beyond the reach of consequence," until the morning of March 14, 1975, when he didn't. He is driving along Darling Street. It is not a notable moment by any visible measure. A man in a car on a Kingston road in the early morning. Then another car pulls alongside his. The men inside open fire. They shoot him in the head more than once. The car does not slow down. The police confirm the basic facts of the killing. The investigation into who ordered it was never publicly resolved. Some accounts pointed to JLP-aligned enforcers retaliating for years of warfare. Other accounts, never verified in any official record, suggested that the political machinery that had built Bury Boy had also, in some fashion, withdrawn the protection that had kept him alive, making him available to his enemies in a way he had not previously been. What moved through Kingston's back channels in the weeks before his death has never been officially established and should not be stated as settled fact. The murder was never solved. What happened afterward was impossible to dispute. The cabinet met. This is the detail, confirmed in papers obtained by TVJ in 2019, that reframes everything. The question put before Manley's cabinet was not whether Bury Boy's funeral should receive a police escort or whether the PNP should issue a statement of condolence. The question was whether cabinet ministers should attend in person. They deliberated. They voted. The decision was that as many members as possible would attend. 21 years later, in a radio interview, Manley was asked whether he regretted that decision. His answer, as reported by TVJ, he fully understood why he had made it. 20,000 people came. The number demands to be held still for a moment, because it carries meaning that no political speech can reproduce. 20,000 mourners for a man the state had never officially acknowledged as anything other than a criminal, for a man who had been accused of murder, assault, political intimidation, and the ethnic cleansing of entire neighborhoods. Manley came, cabinet ministers came, not reluctantly, not covertly, publicly, visibly, at the front of the procession. The Prime Minister of Jamaica walked in mourning behind the casket of the man his government had used, protected, and perhaps in the end released into the space where his enemies could reach him. The procession moved through Kingston toward Maypen Cemetery. It passed the edge of Tivoli Gardens. The gunmen opened fire on the mourners. People scatter. Women grab children. The cabinet ministers who voted to stand at the front of this procession must now stand inside it while bullets come. The political leaders who had built the garrison system, who had armed the men inside those garrisons, who had extended protection in exchange for violence for years, they are standing in the street while the inheritance of all those decisions arrives in the form of live rounds cutting the air above a coffin. The bullets are not an aberration. They are the direct, structural consequence of every decision made since Tavares Gardens was built, since Tivoli Gardens was cleared from Bacco Wall, since Arnett Gardens was filled with displaced people who owed the party their loyalty and were expected to pay it. 6 months after Bury Boy's burial, Feathermop was killed in a bar. A lone gunman who moved quietly through the room shot him several times before he could react. The founding partnership of the Concrete Jungle was over within a year. What rose in their place was harder, deeper, and more entrenched. General Starkey, new crews, new alliances. The structure Bury Boy had built would be inherited by men who had grown up inside it, who had no memory of a time before the garrison, who understood the arrangement not as a political compromise, but as the permanent order of things. The narco-garrison architecture that would define Kingston for the next 3 decades, the shower posse, the crack cocaine networks, the extradition battles that would eventually require a military operation, grew from the same soil that Spalding's housing ministry had broken in the early 1970s. The Concrete Jungle name stayed. Not just as geography, but as cultural fact, embedded permanently in the record by Bob Marley and the Wailers, who named a track after the community and carried its misery into international consciousness. What the name preserved was not only the memory of poverty and violence, it preserved the specific character of a place that had been built as a weapon and then handed over to the people inside it to survive in as best they could. Arnett Gardens is still there. The concrete towers still rise from the same ground. Anthony Spaulding filled with PNP loyalists. The community has continued to produce musicians, athletes, and artists alongside gunmen and dons because that is what garrisons do. They compress human potential and human desperation into the same square footage and let the pressure decide which direction each life breaks. The story about the housing official never went away. It circulated for years after Bury Boy's death, in the garrison, in the bars around Trenchtown, among the people who remembered the 1970s, with the clarity of survivors rather than the nostalgia of politicians. No investigation, no charges, no official accounting, just silence. And the specific quality of silence that settles over a story that too many people with too much to lose have agreed, without ever meeting, to stop telling. Bury Boy was buried in Maypen Cemetery, under a sky that had just been cut by gunfire. Manley went home. The cabinet went home. The 20,000 returned to neighborhoods that had known him, feared him, needed him, and in the complicated, costly, and irreducible way of people who had been given no other options, protected him. The man who replaced him would be harder. The one after that, harder still. Each succession deepening the structure, widening the damage, extending the reach of an arrangement that two political parties had agreed upon in the early 1960s, and that neither had found the will to dismantle. The cabinet voted to go to that funeral. They went, and when the bullets came, they stood there and absorbed the consequence of what they had built. One procession, 20,000 mourners, a coffin, and the particular kind of gunfire that has no intended target, because its only purpose is to remind everyone present that no peace in Kingston is ever final. Winston Blake was not the origin of the garrison system. He was its first completed product, a man the political class built, used, and buried with full ceremony, while the machinery that made him continued running without interruption. So here is the question the streets of Kingston never stopped asking, and that the cabinet papers have now made impossible to ignore. Was Michael Manley's decision to lead that funeral procession an act of political loyalty to a community he genuinely served, or was it the final transaction in an arrangement that had always been about power, never about people? The 20,000 who came to bury Winston Blake had their answer. The gunmen at Tivoli Gardens had theirs. You decide which one the history books have been getting wrong.